For the sake of time, I'll be skipping some of the text that is in gray. Okay? In the first part of the description, I will just mention some of the ideas, and then later they will be summarized for my analysis here. So I hope it will be clear for you. The last two decades have witnessed the development of a movement that attempts to recover theological interpretation of Scripture. Despite the difficulty of defining this movement with precision, its main characteristics may be highlighted. First, rejection of the distance between exegesis and theology prevalent in many academic circles, with particular criticism of the historical critical method. Second, assertion of the church as the proper locus for interpreting Scripture. Third, affirmation of the theological nature of Scripture. And then fourth, the importance of theological presuppositions in biblical interpretation. And fifth, the need of interaction between biblical interpretation and Christian doctrine. Since most of these characteristics resemble ancient Christian practices of biblical interpretation, there is an appreciation and recovery of aspects of patristic exegesis in contemporary theological interpretation of Scripture, TIS. One of the best examples of such recovery is the appropriation of the concept of rule of faith, which attempts to reflect the practice of the early church, notably Irenaeus and Tertullian, of reading Scripture guided by the rule of faith. As Catherine Green McGreath points out, in the early church, this rule was the sum content of the apostolic teaching, a confession of faith, used particularly in baptism, that outlined the authoritative articles of faith. Even though written samples of the rule are not exactly the same, its occurrences in the writings of Irenaeus and Tertullian indicate that the main topics summarized in the rule of faith are the one and Trinitarian God, creation, Christ's incarnation, passion, resurrection, assumption, and second coming, resurrection of the saints, judgment, and salvation. In fact, the outline of the rule of faith was used as a hermeneutical key for the interpretation of Scripture. However, in the context of contemporary TIS, an attentive reading of some of its proponents indicates that there are significant differences about the conception of the rule of faith and its use in biblical interpretation. Hence, the purpose of the present study is to describe and briefly analyze the different proposals of Robert Wall, Joe Green, Daniel Traer, and Kevin Van Hooser. I will start with Robert Wall, just the text in black. For Wall, right interpretation is determined by whether the content and consequence of a text interpretation agree with the church's rule of faith. At the bottom, by denying the notion that Scripture interprets itself, Wall concludes that biblical interpretation demands faithful interpreters guided by the rule of faith. Moreover, he rejects the equation of Scripture with the rule of faith. With this distinction, Wall appears to suggest a primacy of the rule of faith over Scripture, which is expressed especially through the historical argument that the biblical canon took shape in the time of Irenaeus on the basis of the agreement of its content with the rule of faith. Thirdly, Wall's understanding of the scope of the rule of faith is influenced by his conviction that the rule of faith, the rule, is not only a summary of Christian beliefs produced in the past. Rather, only in black, the various traditions or denominations in Christianity today represent different contemporary appropriations of the ancient rule of faith, with distinct emphasis demanded by specific circumstances. In fact, this expanded conception of the scope of the rule of faith implies not only a primacy of this rule over Scripture, but ultimately gives priority of the church over Scripture, since contemporary ecclesiastical traditions function as rule of faith in the process of interpreting Scripture. Joe Green. For Green, in black, doctrine refers to the rule of faith and its codification in the ecumenical creeds of the early church. Green seems to agree with Wall in distinguishing the rule of faith and the Bible. In his view, we cannot argue that the church has simply received its doctrine from the Bible, from a historical perspective. Indeed, the canon of Christian Scripture was not in place at the very time that the rule of faith was taking shape among early church theologians. Furthermore, he claims that taken on their terms, and without recourse to a history or community of interpretation, the biblical texts are capable of multiple interpretations, many of which could be understood as good readings, that is, readings supported by a careful analysis of the text, but not all of which are worthy of the name Christian. Associated with this idea is the notion that the diversity of voices and perspectives within Scripture and among the biblical books finds unity not in Scripture itself, but in the rule of faith. A challenge to Green's position is the question of how he is able to allow both church doctrine and the Bible to speak on their own terms and intentions when there is a disagreement between them. And by doctrine here, I mean creeds of the early church. One example of this situation is the tension between the Bible and the creeds of the early church on the issue of anthropology. More specifically, Green argues that according to biblical anthropology, we do not possess souls, but simply are souls. In other words, we are characterized by indivisibility of our embodied human lives. We have no need for recourse to a second entity, such as soul or spirit. In contrast to this monist view of humanity, the Chalcedonian definition and the Athanasian Creed, both probably from the 5th century, point out that Jesus has a rational soul and body, implying a dualistic anthropological perspective. Nevertheless, Green replies that these creedal statements affirm Jesus' full humanity and not body-soul dualism. Even though these statements employ non-biblical categories and erroneous science, with the result that they use the problematic language of rational soul and human flesh in order to secure the affirmation of Jesus' full humanity, Green believes the creedal statements in question are focused on Christological arguments and are not concerned with theological anthropology per se. In my view, this answer is unsatisfactory, especially because the way in which anthropology is conceived impacts Christology in a significant measure. In fact, a distorted view of anthropology misconstrues the humanity of Christ. In short, Green includes the ecumenical creeds of the early church as part of his definition of the rule of faith, considering that for him, the rule is not to be identified with the Bible. The affirmation that the rule of faith is indispensable for a proper theological interpretation of Scripture implies that ecclesiology has priority over Scripture, at least in terms of the early church. Daniel Traer. According to Traer, truly Christian understanding of Scripture occurs within the boundaries of the rule of faith and even receives helpful guidance for Nicene Orthodoxy. Traer considers the doctrines of ecclesiastical traditions that go beyond the basic information of the rule of faith as extensions of the rule. Then I will have more ideas from Traer in the summary that I will provide. Let's move on to Kevin Van Hooser on page 6. For Van Hooser, the Church Fathers did not mean to control the meaning of Scripture through the use of the rule of faith. Instead, their intention was to confess what Scripture does mean. Thus, confession is the best description of the rule of faith, and this coheres with its ancient use as a baptismal confession. In addition, the purpose of the rule is to provide readers of Scripture with the right presuppositions as to its basic subject matter. Van Hooser emphasized that all exegesis presupposes some theology or other. In fact, the belief that Scripture interprets Scripture never meant that interpretation could take place without interpreters making presuppositions, only that these presuppositions should themselves be drawn from Scripture. Hence, the rule of faith allows Scripture interpret itself by providing presuppositions that come from Scripture itself. For him, the process of biblical interpretation provides us with an opportunity to refine or even correct our prior theological understanding. The foregoing description seems to suggest that these four theologians can be largely divided in two main groups in the context of the hermeneutical use of the rule of faith. One group emphasizes the priority of the church, while the other tends to affirm the primacy of the Bible. Emphasis on the rule of faith and the church, which is the first group. In the first group, Wall and Green maintain two basic ideas about the rule of faith. First, the rule cannot be identified with Scripture, because the former is historically prior to the latter, and the biblical canon took shape having the rule as its criterion. Likewise, one's interpretation of Scripture is valid in the sense of being Christian, inasmuch as it concurs with the rule of faith. Associated with this argument is the idea that Scripture cannot interpret itself, and therefore the rule is needed for biblical interpretation. Second, the rule of faith includes creeds and doctrines of the church. Green seems to include only the creeds of the early church, while for Wall, the rule of faith comprises also the doctrines of contemporary ecclesiastical traditions. Both positions imply a primacy of the church over Scripture. Green's argumentation exposes major implications for this conception of the rule of faith that emphasizes the church. For instance, he attempts to show that the hermeneutical use of the rule does not represent imposition of doctrine on Scripture. However, if the rule of faith and Scripture are not to be identified, and if a proper interpretation of Scripture is absolutely dependent on the use of the rule, then the conclusion of an imposition of doctrine hardly can be avoided. In addition, Green properly identifies a problematic case of disagreement between the creeds and the Bible on the issue of anthropology. However, as I already mentioned, he provides unsatisfactory answers. It seems that a key problem of Green's approach in his distinction is his distinction of theology as an ongoing reflection and doctrine as essentially stable and authoritative. If doctrine is not open to correction, and his definition of rule of faith includes the doctrine of the creeds of the early church, then he cannot properly recognize that the creeds are wrong in their anthropology. In this sense, Green is unable to acknowledge that the anthropology of the creeds negatively affects Christology, particularly misconstruing the concept of the humanity of Christ, and from a systematic perspective, theology as a whole. Therefore, Green's discussion ultimately implies that a conception of rule of faith that emphasizes the church tends to conform the Bible to doctrinal constructions. Emphasis on the rule of faith and Scripture. In the second group, Traer and Van Hooser affirm the identity of the rule of faith with Scripture. They avoid the notion of the rule of faith that emphasizes the church because both of them acknowledge the weakness of the church and tradition and thus highlight the need of biblical correction. Moreover, these theologians stress a conception of rule of faith that works at the level of the theological presuppositions of the interpreter. But since there is an identity between the rule of faith and Scripture, they underline that these presuppositions must come from Scripture itself. In other words, the authority of the rule of faith for hermeneutical purposes depends on its conformity to Scripture. This discussion about presuppositions includes two main aspects, namely the fact that the interpreter has presuppositions and the content of these presuppositions. With regard to the first aspect, Van Hooser and Traer advocates the weakness of the interpreter, just as a church, specifically in terms of his or her finite, falling, and partial perception, which reveals the constant need of correction and refinement of presuppositions as he or she reads Scripture. Concerning the second aspect, Van Hooser believes that the main presupposition of the rule of faith is the acknowledgement of the unity of Scripture, which allows Scripture interpret itself. Concisely, the main contributions of this group are the emphasis on the weakness of the church and the interpreter, and the notion that the rule of faith, and the notion of the rule of faith as a theological presupposition. Nevertheless, two main points are unclear in this approach. Firstly, in Traer's twofold definition of the rule of faith, the narrow definition appears to agree with Green's, a summary of the apostolic teaching in the ecumenical creeds of the early church. And the broad definition seems to concur with Walls. It includes the doctrinal extensions of contemporary ecclesiastical traditions. In fact, his belief that these ecclesiastical traditions and doctrines are necessary for biblical interpretation raises the following questions. How would Traer answer Green's example of disagreement between Scripture and the early creeds? Are the creeds in need of biblical correction in the area of anthropology? If so, could they serve as hermeneutical presuppositions for the interpretation of Scripture? In this case, is it appropriate to consider the creed's rule of faith? Secondly, in the discussion of the identity between the rule of faith and Scripture, Van Hooser and Traer do not seem to answer, at least not explicitly, the argument used by Wall and Green that the rule of faith precedes historically the Bible as a canon, and thus the rule has priority over Scripture. My suggestion is that this discussion may be enriched by the contribution of Oscar Cuman and a short description of the rule of faith in Irenaeus, which may clarify some points of the present analysis. In his discussion of the rule of faith and the biblical canon in the first centuries, Cuman points out that the general distinction between oral tradition and written scripture is not helpful, because in this case, oral tradition historically precedes scripture. As a result, by being identified with oral tradition, the rule of faith is distinguished from scripture. Based on the assumption that oral tradition preceded scripture, it is argued that the rule has priority over scripture. In contrast to this view, Cuman proposes a distinction between apostolic tradition and ecclesiastical or post-apostolic tradition, the former being the foundation of the latter. According to this distinction, what matters is not whether the apostolic tradition was oral or written, but that it was fixed by the apostles. In other words, there is no dichotomy between the rule of faith, conceived only as a summary of the apostolic teaching, and scripture, because both of them are in the category of apostolic tradition. Cuman argues that this view seems to be confirmed by the formation of the biblical canon. Actually, the existence of the canon indicates that the church at one point was losing the criterion for judging the validity of the claim to apostolicity made by the many traditions in circulation. And then the church realized that without a superior written norm, its teaching office could not keep pure the apostolic tradition. Therefore, by establishing the principle of a canon, the church declared implicitly that from that time, every subsequent tradition must be submitted to the control of the apostolic tradition. In fact, the affirmation that the rule of faith historically precedes the scriptures needs to be properly qualified, because the idea of giving normative authority to the rule of faith was conceived at the same time as that of giving a normative authority to the canon, that is to say, about the middle of the second century. To put it differently, the definitive fixing of the apostolic rule of faith corresponded exactly to the same need of codifying the apostolic tradition as did the canonization of the apostolic writings. The two form henceforth one block of apostolic tradition over against the post-apostolic tradition. In this sense, the concept of apostolic tradition, which comprises rule of faith and scripture, restricts the scope of the rule only to the apostolic tradition, which does not include the post-apostolic creeds and doctrines of the church. In addition, this concept affirms the identity of the rule of faith and scripture. Actually, this identity seems to be confirmed by Irenaeus in the second century. Irenaeus refers to the rule of faith as the truth, the canon or rule of truth, which is conceived by him as a hermeneutical framework for a proper interpretation of Scripture. Hence, the rule of faith is an organic system or framework which constitutes the shape and the meaning of God's revelation. Without the system, God's revelation is not intelligible. Placed within another system, that revelation is distorted and perverted, and this is the case of the Valentinians in his writings. Their approach is graphically compared to someone rearranging the pieces of a beautiful image of a king in a mosaic, constructed out of precious jewels by a skillful artist into the image of a dog or a fox. In other words, they pull apart the system found in Scripture and use its pieces to create their own system. Nevertheless, Irenaeus emphasizes that those who previously know the correct system of Scripture are capable of recognizing the biblical pieces without being deceived by the false mosaic. In his words, someone who retains unchangeable in his heart the rule of faith, the rule of truth, which he received by means of baptism, will doubtless recognize the names, the expressions, and the parables taken from the Scriptures, but will by no means acknowledge the blasphemous use which these men make of them. In these considerations, the rule of faith seems to be described as a framework or system that serves as the correct presuppositions or pre-understanding for the activity of biblical interpretation. However, this rule does not appear to be distinguished from Scripture. In his criticism of the Valentinians, Irenaeus argues that their system is derived neither from what the prophets announced, nor the Lord taught, nor the apostles delivered. Rather, they gave their views from other sources than the Scriptures, and communicate them using the language of the parables of the Lord, the sayings of the prophets, and the words of the apostles, in order that their scheme may not seem altogether without support. In this way, by violently drawing away from their proper connection, words, expressions, and parables whenever found, the Valentinians disregard the order and the connection of the Scriptures, and ultimately dismember and destroy the truth. For Irenaeus, this practice of collecting a set of expressions and names scattered here and there in Scripture twists them from a natural to a non-natural sense. Elsewhere, Irenaeus points out that the entire Scriptures, the prophets, and the Gospels can be clearly, unambiguously, and harmoniously understood by all. In this sense, one should not apply expressions which are not clear or evident to interpretations of the parables, because if this is done, no one will possess the rule of truth, but in accordance with the number of persons who explain the parables, will be found the various systems of truth in mutual opposition to each other. On the other hand, if the interpretation is based on what is clear and evident in Scripture, then the body of the truth remains entire, with a harmonious adaptation of its members and without any collision of its several parts. In short, it seems clear that Irenaeus affirms the identity between the rule of faith and Scripture, and that this rule is derived from Scripture. The description and brief analysis of the concept of the rule of faith in biblical interpretation in the context of contemporary TIS was particularly helpful for the identification and clarification of the main issues involved in this discussion. Even though the contribution of Kuhlmann and the exposition of Irenaeus' view of the rule of faith are not included in this paper as the final criteria to judge the plausibility of the proposals of contemporary TIS, they do offer significant insights for the understanding of the relationship between the rule of faith and Scripture, especially considering that contemporary TIS aims at recovering the practices of the early church as exemplified by Irenaeus' use of the rule of faith. I conclude this paper by highlighting two main issues. First, there is a general tendency in contemporary TIS of defining the rule of faith in a large scope that goes beyond the summary of the apostolic teaching. While Green adds the creeds of the early church, Wall and Traer tend to include also extensions of contemporary ecclesiastical doctrines and tradition. From the perspective of Kuhlmann's distinction of apostolic and post-apostolic traditions and Irenaeus' notion that the rule of faith is derived from Scripture, the large scope of the definitions of rule of faith in TIS clearly includes post-apostolic tradition, which is not normative for biblical interpretation. By being weak and limited, post-apostolic tradition needs biblical correction. Therefore, if this large scope of the rule of faith is maintained, TIS will correctly affirm the theological nature of Scripture and challenge the historical critical method by wrongly using in an intentional way post-apostolic traditions as a rule for biblical interpretation. Secondly, in its discussion of the rule of faith, contemporary TIS properly recognized the role of presuppositions or pre-understanding in biblical interpretation, particularly emphasizing the influence of doctrine on one's interpretation of Scripture. However, in the light of Kuhlman's concept of apostolic and post-apostolic tradition, I will suggest that doctrine should not be considered rule of faith for interpretation in the sense of not being authoritative for determining one's interpretation. Rather, doctrine should be conceived as a cognitive construction of weak and limited interpreters of the Bible, which implies the need of a constant study of Scripture in order to correct or enrich the doctrinal understanding of the interpreters. Actually, this picture of biblical interpretation may be summarized in the following way. First, there is an acknowledgement that one's doctrinal understanding influences his or her readings of Scripture in the sense that this doctrinal pre-understanding works as presupposition for the interpretation of the Bible. Second, this pre-understanding, needs to be constantly evaluated, corrected, and enriched by the biblical text so that these presuppositions can be constantly reshaped by Scripture. In fact, this ongoing movement from these presuppositions to Scripture and from Scripture to presuppositions may suggest a close relationship between systematic theology in the study of doctrine and biblical studies in exegesis in the process of biblical interpretation.